Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every daily supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is so mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Marco Moreira, who is the chef owner of 15 East at Tocqueville in New York. He joined us in episode 28 and discussed his fascinating background, including how the young Brazilian man came to New York and became a sushi chef, and shared his deep knowledge of Japanese food culture. And Marco has run highly successful multiple restaurants in New York with a wide variety of influences from Japanese, French, and Brazilian flavors. And no restaurant was unaffected by COVID, but Marco navigated tremendous challenges very well and opened a new restaurant called 15 East Tocqueville after the pandemic. And 15 East at Tocqueville is an innovative concept because Japanese food and French are served both authentically and seamlessly under one roof without being gimmicky. So today we'll discuss the unique concept of 15 East at Tocqueville, why Marco decided to the contrasting culinary genres in one space, his point of view about how Japanese sushi has become mainstream of the American food culture, and much, much more. But before we start, Japanese is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Marco Moreira. Hello, Marco. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Kiko. Thank you for having me.
So for listeners who have not listened to your very intriguing life story in episode 28, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
Well, I was born in Brazil. My family is mostly Italian and also a little Iberian with a little French. But I was born in Brazil, and when I was 16 years old, I had the opportunity to come to travel to New York City to visit as a young man. And that was in 1982 when I first arrived here.
Right. So it must have been a very impressive trip.
It was an amazing trip. And honestly, one of the goals to be here was to brush up my English. And at the end of my visit at 6 months, I wasn't happy with, I still needed more. I needed to learn more about the culture. I wanted to learn more about my English. And so I decided to extend my trip.
Right. And one thing you didn't mention, your mother-in-law was Japanese and he grew up eating kind of Japanese food, traditional Japanese food, right?
Yes, actually, I'm São Paulo is it's a huge Japanese city for the Japanese culture. The lots of Japanese. I'm told them is the second biggest Japanese city in the world. Certainly, the one that's the biggest outside of Japan. And my mother married a lovely lady who is from Kyoto originally, whose family migrated to Brazil in the 50s. So I was introduced to the culture very, 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 very early on.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, and also you, after you moved to New York, you decided to become a sushi chef. So what happened?
Well, sushi wasn't really my dream to become an expert in. It was really just the restaurant in general. And I didn't know if I wanted to be a chef or an operator or a sommelier, or I had no idea. All I know is that when I got the opportunity to learn in a restaurant, I was very, very happy to just do whatever and learn so much and get paid. So it seemed like, wow, I'm learning, I'm going to school and I'm learning and I'm getting paid. So, but lucky for me, you know, in the 80s was a time where, you know, the sushi cuisine was becoming really, really trendy and it was a novelty, really. The boss who I worked for, Morifuji-san, he said, you know, after trials of me making sushi on my own for the family and after lunch service, you know, he'd let me play with the rice. And he said, eventually, you like it so much, I got you. I'm going to train you to be a sushi chef. And I thought it was a joke, but it really wasn't. And so he took me under his wing, and he was a very good sensei for me. Mm. I was very lucky.
Right. Well, such an honorable thing, because sushi chefs are known for being difficult to convince you to be to take care of you. So, yeah, you must be really good. Yeah. So, what part of sushi attracted you so much?
Well, first of all, I'm a huge foodie, and what's not to like about beautiful raw fish and the rice? But really, initially, it was more the culture. You know, I loved the camaraderie of the Japanese working together. We actually had little side projects that we did. He threw in some golfing, and it was a very tight family like ambiance that made me feel really at home and comfortable, and you know, I had that feeling that I was being taken care of. I knew I was very lucky to have found this opportunity. So initially, that was the first attraction, and then as I became more advanced and I started making my own, you know, it's a long process. You learn to, you know, do the minor preps, and you start learning how to make the rice, and, you know, your rice is never right. And, you know, you keep trying, and consistency and perseverance, eventually being able to make my own sushi, it was just amazing. It was really incredible. So what do I like about it? I think I like all of it. I mean, every little plate that you prepare, it becomes your little child, and you become very proud of that you're able to do that. So I was pretty young. I was 18 years old when I started. So, it sort of gave me a little bit of a direction also, because I found my passion. You know, mm-hmm. I was lucky that I knew I wanted to be in the restaurant business, and I had given this very special opportunity to learn something that's very special, which is, you know, it's a specialty of cuisine, which is sushi. And, so I jumped on it.
Right. And then what's amazing about just Korea, this is so interesting. So you also studied authentic French cuisine. So could you tell us where you worked and what you learned from cooking French? And also, what is the charm of classic French cuisine to you personally?
Being a sushi chef and being, you know, someone that loved cooking, and I was around growing up, amazing cooks, my mom, my grandmothers, my two grandmothers, the different melding cultures in Brazil. You have the Portuguese cuisine, the Spanish cuisine, the Italian cuisine. There's also a lot of Lebanese and Syrian culture there. So we always loved food. And so I really didn't start cooking until after I learned how to make sushi. But in tandem with learning about the sushi, I started learning also just on my own how to, take cookbooks and start cooking on my own by myself. And, I never went to a cooking school. I just went to, I took little courses at the time. I went to the New York Restaurant School. They used to be on 34th Street. And I remember the first course that I took, it was called How to Boil Water. And I loved it. I kept going. I took a few classes there, how to bake. But it wasn't until I got into a professional kitchen that I, once given that opportunity, that I really started to learn, and I worked my way up and just in restaurants. Mm.
Right. And you worked at the Boulay? Did you...
I did, yes. That was a few years later. I had worked in some other restaurants before, but I think the chance to come to Stage à Boulay after having eaten there and had so many amazing restaurants in New York City and outside of New York. I saw what was going on in the kitchen at Boulay, I was like, wow, this is really what I need to be doing with my life. Like, this is really something extraordinary that you don't see every day. So I started my apprenticeship I got an opportunity to go work there.
Mm. Right. So for listeners who are not familiar with Boulay is one of the most important restaurants in New York, because it's not just a great restaurant. It's closed now, but it's kind of like a graduate school for great French chefs. So it's a palace. It's an institution. So it's interesting how you classically both train yourself in Japanese and French cuisine. So, yeah, very impressive.
Yeah, it was really, you don't understand. I had never seen anything like it, being in that kind of environment. So, the hours were long. It was a grueling. We never had time for anything. You're always behind. You never had the time. You're never ahead of your work. And the days became even longer because you wanted to do even better every day. And it wasn't just me. It was just everybody. We were all there on a mission to produce the most beautiful yet tasty food in New York City. And that definitely changed my perspective on food.
Mm, right. So now we see that at your restaurant, what you've learned, and in both culinary genres. So we'll take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll dive into how Marco merges Japanese and French dining experiences in one place without diluting either. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats on Heritage Radio Network, HRN. I'm your host, Kiko Katayama, and my guest today is Marco Moreira, who is the chef owner of 15 East at Tocqueville in New York. So you opened 15 East at Tocqueville in October 2020 after the pandemic kind of started to calm down. And we'll talk about the concept of the restaurant in a moment, but to get there, you had a bumpy road. So could you tell us what happened?
Well, I was fortunate to open my first restaurant in the year 2000. I was at the time working, running the kitchen at the Mark Hotel in New York City. And after a couple of years looking for a space, I was lucky to find the ideal location, which is half a block from Union Square Farmers Market. And so we opened the restaurant in February of the year 2000. So, you know, we're definitely very lucky. We're a hit from day one. We did it very well. We definitely were noticed very quickly. We're more of a uptown atmosphere restaurant with the downtown approach, a little more casual. So I think it's this combination, this style of restaurants have become more popularized since I opened my restaurant.
Right. So that's the Tocqueville. That's the French restaurant, Tocqueville, right?
Correct. Yeah, we opened. Yeah, that was in 2000.
Right.
It was just amazing. We're working, you know, the long hours, and we didn't count the hours. We just loved life. And yes, there were lots of bumps. Shortly after we opened, we had 9/11, and we've had hurricanes and power outages, and the financial. The 2008 financial implosion, you know, that these are all, you know, part of the of all the bumps that we had. But we were lucky. We did very well. We managed, and we stayed on the mission. We didn't change anything. And then in 2006, we actually had the opportunity to take over a space which was right on the block, just a few feet down from my original space, and reopen Tocqueville. Although we wanted to keep the name because it was in my mind was just a bigger, better, nicer space. But it really was we created something that was different from the original Tocqueville. We quadruple in space, and we had maybe 20% more seats than the original space, but so a lot of the square footage that we gained went towards the structure of the restaurant and infrastructure, such as, you know, more kitchen space, more offices. We had a proper cellar, we had a locker room. We actually were able to put in a private dining room. And so, it was you know, the much improved space in every way. 20-foot ceilings. I mean, it was as beautiful as the original Tocqueville was. The new space really was something that we, didn't hold back. It was definitely a new restaurant.
Right. And then you expanded to the sushi restaurant, 15 East, right?
Yeah, so the original space of Tocqueville, once we opened at the new location, I always knew I wanted to do a Japanese restaurant. So I, at the time in 06, again, we were one of the first sushi counters that we offered our omakase menu only. So... And we transformed that space into our modern Japanese restaurant. We had a lengthy menu for the kitchen as well as the omakase counter as well.
Mm, right. So the 15 East became really popular. And remember, there was like two beautiful spaces. One is a sushi bar. The other one is like dining room. And it was such a special place.
Thank you.
But, you know, after that, I mean, the COVID happened. And so eventually you merged the two restaurants, right? So Tocqueville and 15 East, which you opened in October 2020. And just to make it quick, so you had a beautiful, amazing space out of fire. You have to renovate it. But then you reopened in November last year as completely newly renovated space, which is stunningly beautiful. So what is the concept of this combined restaurant concept, 15 East at Tocqueville?
Well, thank you for the compliment. As we were all trying to figure out on the fly how to navigate this COVID thing, we didn't know how long it was going to last and how to manage. And we're all antsy and we always wanted to come back as quickly as possible. And so in October of 2020, so it's a few months after we had shut down because of the COVID, we were able to reopen the restaurant with a outdoor terrace, which more than double our capacity. So we had both our teams from 15 East and Tocqueville working together in the same restaurant space. And I created a menu that would be, I hate to use confusion, no fusion, no confusion. I hate to say we don't do fusion. I did a menu that would match very, very well as much as possible without being, too cute. And actually, people really loved the two concepts. A lot of the clientele came to both restaurants and they loved, they matched the raw fish with the French. And we had no idea, but it was a huge hit. Yeah, it was very well received, as the two concepts as put one.
Mm. Well, I also heard that actual regular customers at Tocqueville asked for 15 East sushi. They just get $2 away, so just bring me. And because it's regular, so you used to do that, right?
That is true. So for a few customers, a few regulars that, they knew, we would make the exception to bring in food from Tocqueville to 15 East and vice versa. So it didn't seem right to say no, since we're like basically just next door to each other. So yeah, we did that quite a bit.
Right. Well, when I heard about the episode, I was really impressed because people used to say that the smell of soy sauce and butter fight against each other. And it's impossible to combine them on one table.
I love butter with soy sauce. So
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I mean, if you put the butter and then the soy sauce on very steaming hot rice, it's just heavenly. So, but people didn't imagine to put them together, but you proved it really works to be able to have fresh raw fish and classically created a very beautifully sauce-based cuisine. So, yeah, I really found 15 years at Tocqueville's very interesting and very successful, not just as a restaurant business, but also the concept of what people can enjoy without choosing genre. You just want to eat good food and hopefully in one place because you want to go out with friends with different preferences. So, yeah, I really think you did something amazing.
So the food, thank you very much for saying that. So more often than not, people would like to combine. They like the idea of having the Japanese side of the menu with the French. And I would say that 95% of the guests, when they come here, they'll go like the direction of the combination or just sushi. So very seldom people will only want the sushi. Maybe they'll come in, have a little sashimi, and then have a little sushi afterwards. But the most popular menu that we sell, actually, it's a five-course tasty menu, which includes some raw fish, includes chawanmushi, and as well as the European style menu as well.
Mm, right. And also, I think you have sashimi omakase and those different additional menu you can add to other French dishes. And I think it's fascinating because I see all those raw fish items like ceviche kind of or crudo in many non-Japanese restaurants, which is the same idea, a refreshing raw fish and enjoy with richer food. So to me, that's very natural rather than kind of, you know, new ideas. It's pretty kind of classic idea that's being accepted in New York City dining scenes.
For me, I never saw a difference between, yes, if you're doing very traditional Japanese cuisine, versus, classical French, but I never see a line between the two. So, for instance, I was lucky to work with Barry Wine at the Côte Giraffe, and back in the day, he also liked to play around with some Japanese ideas, not going, too crazy, but certainly would see an influence of his of both the Japanese and the French in his restaurant. So I wouldn't say that Barry called his restaurant one or the other, but, you know, one food critic, for instance, at the time said was the best Japanese restaurant in the United States, even though we didn't see ourselves as being a Japanese restaurant. But, you know, we gladly took the compliment for sure. And, but, you know, this is all part of the progression. So, the original Tocqueville, I already served a lot of sakes by the bottle and by the glass. This is back in 2000. I had tempura, I had custard, I had sashimi on the menu. So this is really an evolution of what I've been doing for my four-year career. So it's always sort of, you all kind of like, I can connect the dots, you know, sort of make sense. I'm reinventing, reinventing recipes or new dishes, but maybe the techniques are all sort of the same and there's a natural evolution that's not so forced.
Right. And also I think globally, all the distribution of ingredients are improving, especially fish. Here in New York City, you can have sushi-grade fish at any restaurant. So what do you think, if our listeners go to the restaurant and then like want to order something, like what's the best way to enjoy both concepts?
Well, I think, you know, if you want a very elegant evening and you want to stay here and you have 3 hours to enjoy dinner, for sure the dining room will give you that kind of experience. And as a lot of people do, they'll come in and have the tasty menu. So, and just even put their hands, you know, put it, be in the hands of the sommelier, so he can surprise you with the food, he can surprise you with the wine. You know, if you want, if you just, you know, you want, it's a regular, maybe it's not a night that you want to be here for 3.5 hours and you want to just have 3 courses, then come in and you know, again, you're not, you can create your own menu and you can start with a little sashimi and then, you know, have a beautiful piece of fish or steak for dinner and a dessert. And it doesn't have to be that kind of a experience, but certainly you can, you have a choice and you can go either direction. You don't need to even have a preconceived idea what your evening is going to be. You have add-on things that you can add to your tasting menu, for instance. The omakase room actually is opening next week. So there will be one room that's completely dedicated to having a 20-course all sushi, sashimi, omakase style of dining.
Mm. Right. I know the sushi chef who used to be at Kyoya, that was, it's an amazing restaurant, Katsushi Sakai, right? He was an amazing chef, so he's gonna.
Well, he is an amazing chef. Yes, he's been with us since actually, since 2020, and so we've had the chance to work all this time, and he's been manning the sushi menu for the restaurant. He's incredible. Yes, he's so passionate about Edo style sushi, which is as you know, it's the, you know, the purest, more straightforward, all emphasis on the sushi style of the cuisine.
Right, so as classic as your other French dishes, although they're not heavy, very light. So, yeah, this is amazing. So, by the way, you know, I guess we can say now that sushi has become part of American cuisine at this point. For example, in New York, sushi is available at supermarkets and delis, and there are, I heard, approximately 19,000 sushi restaurants in America, and also there are around 23,000 Japanese restaurants in the whole country. So, but I heard that back in 1960s, people loathed the idea of eating raw fish. So why do you think sushi is so widely accepted nowadays in the U.S. and in the world?
As a side note, one of my first gigs, and my sensei, he was going back to Japan, and he wanted to take me to Japan to open a sushi restaurant with him. But instead, I opted for another gig, which was to have my own sushi concession at Dino De Luca at the time. It was 1989. And Dino De Luca had just opened their flagship store in Soho. And from my sushi catering days, the GM of the store in Giorgio De Luca, they had me come in and, you know, put a proposal for them. And that was the first supermarket that had sushi, I think, in New York at the time. So that was, I was doing that then also. And after that, I became also a sushi consultant. And I went to help Harry's Teeter, which is a chain of supermarkets. They have hundreds of stores. And I helped them organize and set their sushi program for them as well. So it doesn't surprise me when you say it's become so popular. This is well, first of all, it's super healthy, right? Number one, it's delicious. Number two, what's not to like? you know, it's become so popular that it's almost an expected choice in a lot of the gourmet shops. You're looking for them, and you know, people just go for it. And you know, it doesn't have to be you know, fine dining sushi. There's a lot of stores selling, and you know, maybe you're not gonna find the more expensive the fish. That's is maybe it's not a freshness thing. Maybe it's just the, you know, if it's farm raised or if it's you know, depending of where it's imported from. So he can, you know, it became very popularized that way because it's delicious and people want it. And you know, there is different degrees of expectations for any cuisine, and you know, that was translated to sushi as well.
Right. Yeah, I mean, nowadays in New York, there are so many, like over 300 per person authentic sushi restaurants that's rooted from Japan. And also, there's some non-Japanese amazing sushi chefs classically trained at those places. But I don't think we should never forget that someone like you, who reopened the door, how to enjoy sushi more broadly than exclusive sushi places. So yeah, we admire what you did, and especially 15 years at Tocqueville. I think it's almost reflecting who you are, right? Your cultural background and the experience, it's in one place. So it's not the concept, it's about the representative idea of who you are that you really express at 15 years at Tocqueville.
I would agree with you that you know, as I'm creating an idea of a restaurant and even the menu, it's almost in a selfish way that I'm doing it, because I want to have the best of both worlds, and I'm betting that my guests want to the same experience. So I'm betting on my taste and my expectations, and and sort of like, imagining like an ideal setting for like an amazing experience that will include a little bit of all of the above.
Right. Okay. So what are your plans and dreams?
Ooh, plans and dreams. Take over the world.
I think you can.
Well, we're just relaunching our 15 East of Tocqueville, which was a 2-year process almost. We had the devastating fire, and with all the delays and stuff, it took a year and a half to get open. So I feel that the restaurant is still growing, developing, and you know, requiring a lot of attention. But you know, my dream would be to make this restaurant be like my past restaurants. Running very well and rebuilding. A loyal clientele as I've had, and make a great restaurant as it can be. And with the old space next door, we actually want to do a different concept of a restaurant. It'll be more of a tapas, a little bit less formal than Tocqueville and 15 East. But, you know, still fine dining, just a little bit more informal than what we're doing here.
Right. Wow. I can't wait to see what's going to happen in the next door. So yeah, keep me posted. And so where can we find your updates online and on social media?
So we have our Instagram. It's 15 East at Tocqueville. Well, of course, we have a e-blast, a newsletter that we send periodically to our guests. And if anyone would like to receive that, just send us a quick note on our website, and it makes it very easy for you to reach us. If you go on our website, just go on the contact We send out, we have about 30,000 names in our newsletter that we reach out, almost every 2-3 weeks with new menus and ingredients and any news or anything. We just try to stay in contact with our friends that way.
Right. So the 15 East at Tocqueville, you spell out everything, right? 15 East at Tocqueville. And then
correct.
You can get the website mm-hmm. and the Instagram, social media.
Yes.
Great. Wonderful. So, so thank you so much for joining us again today, Marco, and good luck.
Akiko, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It was an honor to be invited back to your show. Thank you so much.
Thank you. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. Japaneats is a weekly program and is always available at heritageradionetwork.org as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. I'm Jenny Zalman's Benjamin, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japaneats is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.